Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Mary McDougall and I'm delighted to welcome today's guest Simon Brewer, former Chief Investment Officer of European Branch of US Investment Bank Morgan Stanley. Simon is currently Senior Advisor to Rothschild & Co and host of the Money Maze podcast, where he has interviewed all sorts of interesting business leaders and financiers. Simon, welcome. How does it feel to be on the other side of the interview table?
Well, first of all, thank you. And secondly, may I let you know in about half an hour?
Well, in your podcast, you tend to focus more than we do on the careers of your guests, how they've climbed the ranks, how they think and what advice they have. I highly recommend it. But we chat more specifically about investing, markets and economics. So with that in mind, there's a lot going on at the moment. Broad question to start with. What pockets of equity markets do you think represent the best value at the moment?
Yes, well, I think there's a danger. You know, our business, the investment business, likes to use acronyms. It likes to use generalizations. People talk about expensive stock markets, but you dive into the detail and the most expensive stock market of the major stock markets is the US. Admittedly, it is over 60% of the world index, but by any measurements of valuation, the US is an expensive stock market historically. You can argue that with bond yields where they are, the US stock market doesn't look so expensive, but that begs the question of, are yields, as reflected in current bond prices, the right level? So therefore, be very careful about, you know, making a measurement of cheapness or expensiveness on something that is already, you know, overvalued. So the US may have the growth companies, which is why that it has been a destination for capital, much more than other markets we might talk about. But there are lots of very interesting opportunities around the world. And I would split that answer into the geographical dispersion. Places like the UK that are cheap relative to history, significantly cheap. Parts of Asia that are similarly so. By sector dispersion, because we know what's happened to the ratings of technology companies, but the absolute inverse of that is what has been going on in the energy complex. And then we have, you know, as a component of that, the whole growth versus value equation, where growth has outstripped value comprehensively for 20 years. And some of us, like myself, have been allocating, you know, more to value in the expectation that we have a regime shift underway.
Yes, well, there's lots to pick up on there. I think if we start with the US, the stock market's faltered a little in the last couple of weeks with inflation expectations, and I think people are increasingly more worried about a tightening of monetary policy or that that's more likely to happen soon, and we've seen a little bit of a sell-off. What are your thoughts on inflation? Do you think that central banks are right and that it will be transitory, or are you worried it might prove longer lasting?
Or call me a hoary old cynic, but I think the central banks are engaging in some wishful thinking. I think that this inflation, part of which can be attributed to the unlock and the supply interruptions, is going to prove significantly more sticky. It seems to be getting itself embedded into all sorts of areas, including labour. And yet I think the central banks will argue that it is a temporary phenomenon. And that, of course, suits the fact that they are having to deal with a colossal amount of debt, you know, on which these economies and individuals are, you know, are sitting. And so any sharp rise in rates is going to have, you know, the effect of strangling the economy. But on the other hand, they have to balance what happens if an inflation really gets embedded in the system. We've been there before, you know, on multiple occasions, and that creates, you know, super serious problems for central banks. So I think, in answer to your question, that it's more serious than they believe. And I think that that will affect asset allocations and has all sorts of investment implications.
You mentioned the growth value split in your previous answer. Do you think, in the context of inflation, investors might be better off in value stocks or...
Well, look, I think that there's always a danger that, you know, one looks at these things in sort of binary terms and it's much more shades of grey in investing. If you look at the UK market, which is very cheap historically, Morgan Stanley had produced some work a few months ago, which factually draws attention to the fact that it is I think, on a 25-year relative low and maybe a 30-year absolute valuation low. And there are lots of reasons for why the UK is out of favour, started with Brexit, not helped by COVID, and because of the composition of the index with sort of all sorts of companies in there that some would say aren't attractive and don't represent sort of, you know, the future. But of course, you know, what price do you want to pay for growth? You know, the great technology companies of the US, the Googles and the Amazons and the Apples, well, we all know about their extraordinary success. We all use their products a lot. But, you know, we have also a situation where their tax rates are significantly below the average corporate tax rate, you know, particularly in the US, which I think might be around 22%. They have engaged in, you know, very successful executions, but they have monopoly positions. And in the same way that the Chinese have responded to the growing influence and control of their tech companies, so there's increasing debate in the US. So I think you have to argue that, you know, with rates potentially rising in an inflationary environment, are those companies going to be where you source compelling returns going forward? And you know, I think there's better value elsewhere, both geographically and from a sector standpoint.
Have you been increasing your value to the UK recently, your allocation to the UK?
Yes. Well, I mean, I have, and I was certainly have been too soon in, you know, in doing that. A number of reasons. Sterling got very cheap, and I don't see the bearish case for sterling being as strong as some have, you know, some have argued. And I think the UK represents, well, factually represents, you know, some very interesting value. And you can look, you know, at the dividend yield of the market, you know, in a world where there is zero on cash and, in fact, negative real. And not just the UK. Other parts, which we might come to in a minute, of, you know, of Asia. But yes, I have increased my allocation to the UK, and I've done it through a mixture of passive and active decisions of certain areas that I want to be more exposed to.
I guess something that everyone in the UK and beyond is feeling at the moment is the energy crisis. Gas prices have quadrupled since February. Inventories at European storage facilities are at historically low levels for this time of year. Pipeline flows from Russia and Norway have been limited. How do you think investors should be thinking about this? What are the risks it might pose to stocks? And also, are there opportunities? Should people be buying oil companies?
Look, it's a fascinating question, because this whole energy complex, it's got a political dimension and it's got a valuation dimension. I think if you answer the first part of your question, which is this a potential real issue for lots of parts of the world, but UK and Europe, and we're seeing it in China as well? Absolutely. You know, it is a, you know, it is a, been a function of all sorts of, you know, issues, part of which has been in pursuing a, you know, in the UK's case, but in pursuing a stronger carbon agenda. You know, a lot of decisions have been made that, quite frankly, look a bit curious, from, you know, running down, you know, gas reserves and storage capabilities to Europe's reliance on, you know, Russia's pipelines. And let's face it, you know, anything that allows the Russian authorities to, you know, to be, how should we say this, but to be able to exercise their influence and leverage will be to, you know, played to their advantage and played to the maximum. So these high oil prices, high gas prices, and it's particularly gas, I think are a shorter term problem. And I think then one needs to distinguish between, can in fact there be a supply response? Because, you know, how do you solve higher problems in the energy where you produce more energy? But the problem is that a lot of the major companies have cut back on investment, because in this energy transition, and because of activism and sort of the, you know, the kind of the issues around ESG, a lot of these oil companies, of course, are being discouraged from, you know, further investments. Now, does that create opportunity? My argument is it does. And I think there are, you know, there's the valuation case that here in the UK, the Shells and the BPs have, you know, handsome dividend yields and strong free cash flows and stock buybacks, you know, but it's true of the energy complex overall. Now, the ESG argument is clearly that these are the polluters and, you know, kind of they're the enemy of the investment community. And I just think that's too straightforward. You know, if you want to work with the BPs and Shells on their journey towards being more environmentally friendly, do you want to sell your holdings and have them end up in a passive you know, vehicle? Or do you want to, if you're an institutional investor, do you want to actually engage with them? And I think engagement is absolutely the way forward. And I think if you're an individual investor, you have to look and you have to say, well, hang on a second, I remember the tobacco stocks, it was a reason for disinvesting from them, and they proceeded to have very strong cash flows and business models and very handsome returns to investors. So, you know, I think you have to think about, you know, the investment part, however important it is we make this journey. It's the speed with which certain constituencies think we can shift to, you know, a greener economy that I think is causing, you know, part of that problem.
It's very interesting. And I would agree with you that engagement probably over exclusion is a better way to help us transform. So just one more question on the UK. The UK is sort of trying to turn itself into more of a tech hub. We've had the Hill review to relax the listing rules. Oxford Nanopore listed this morning. Its stock price has surged. But there are more structural problems. Do you feel positive about the future for UK growth companies or not?
I think that I feel quite positive that actually the UK as a destination for capital, in terms of its valuation of its market, in terms of its currency, in terms of its ability to, you know, to navigate all these cross currents post Brexit, and you know actually makes it quite well placed. So I don't see the reasons to be bearish on the UK. Quite the contrary. In terms of appetite to encourage more tech companies, you know, I don't really know enough about those companies. When you start sort of lightening the listing requirements because you want to be seen to be, you know, a tech hub, you know, that does that necessarily attract all the most interesting companies? So I'm a little less clear. That certainly wouldn't be the reason for me to want to own UK assets.
Okay. You mentioned Asia earlier. We're all on tenterhooks watching what will happen with Chinese real estate company Evergrande, which is struggling to service its debt. It sold part of its holding in a bank to a Chinese state-owned enterprise recently. What are your thoughts on the gravity of the situation and its implication for the Chinese economy?
Well, I think there's the Evergrande specific situation, and there's the Chinese economy and the Chinese and Hong Kong equity markets, and they're related short term, but they're not related long term. I don't think the Chinese will allow Evergrande to create a systemic risk to their financial system. You may see the board of Evergrande taken out and not seen again for some time, but I think that they will manage this transition. They can control, you know, they can control it and create, you know, the right vehicles to deal with, you know, the bad assets, etc. I think that raises the question of, should one be interested in a part of the world that is, you know, large and growing, but where there is, you know, there are great geopolitical issues, whilst there are many stocks on 8% dividend yields with sound balance sheets and cash flows that might not be in the trigger of the Chinese authorities. So it's one of those classic dilemmas. You have geopolitical risk, and that needs to be taken into account. But you have some terrific valuation. And, you know, even Hong Kong, I think I'm right in saying that for the last 40 years or so, Hong Kong companies have had a very similar return on equity to the US listed equities in general. And yet their valuation is a fraction of the US's, because there's been quite a considerable amount of discounting going on. Do I think there's value there? Yeah, I do. I'm beginning to allocate a little bit of capital there. But, you know, the Asian sort of theater for investments, I think, remains, you know, compelling. And there are lots of, you know, good companies and interesting opportunities.
How much do you think might be appropriate for a private investor to have allocated to Asia and within that China?
Yes, well, I think that if you took the equity piece of an individual's allocation, and let's say it's 50%, but let's imagine it's 100%. So we gross it up to 100%. What is the allocation that I want to have to Asia, including Hong Kong? For me, it's around 15%. And of that, you know, the China Hong Kong component is, you know, probably as much as I think I'm building towards a third of that, so 5%.
Okay, and how much in the US?
Oh, well, see, so the US, that's interesting. I mean, I have been moving away, you know, from the US for a while. So I think that actually I probably would not want to have much more than half of the the US's weight. So the US is 60% of the world index right now. I think as an individual investor, I would want to have sort of half of that, not more, finding more value elsewhere. An institutional investor couldn't do that because of all the benchmark risks, that are attendant with that. But I think individual investors can take a much stronger view about how much they want in any given region.
I think another area that's very interesting at the moment is private equity. Private equity's been circling around all sorts of companies. What's your view on investing in private equity investment trusts, that being the main way that private investors can get access?
Yeah, well, I don't claim to have any sort of great insights, into the world of private equity. I see institutional investors obviously accessing it, directly or through some of the larger funds like KKR and Carlyle. I think that one has to always be very conscious of the illiquidity that comes with direct private investing. I think that some of these funds that have been created, and if you think back all the way to, Electra and 3i, I mean, there have been vehicles that have been around for a long time. I'm just worried a little bit that people chasing returns and chasing yield and seeing particularly the returns that private equity has generated are maybe allocating to that space from parts of their portfolio that were previously more defensive. Because in a world where bonds yield nothing, you keep on looking around for returns, you go up the risk curve, but you also go the wrong way up or down the liquidity curve. So you're taking more risk and you're getting less liquidity. And I think that one needs to be careful, it would be my own sense, because to assess the risk in private equity and to access the best managers, you need scale and size and resources, and it's difficult for individual investors to achieve those.
Yeah, that's fair. Linking back to, we were talking earlier about inflation and different ways that people can protect themselves from inflation. I think one traditionally would be short-dated index-linked government bonds, but they are very expensive. So what's your view on index-linked government bonds specifically, and then fixed income more broadly and its place within a portfolio?
Well, I mean, we know the traditional portfolio for individuals sort of worked around either 60-40 equity bonds or some variation thereof. And that was in a world where we used to get a yield, a nominal yield, and some inflation protection. And the world's been turned on its head now, courtesy of central banks' policies and zero nominal rates, but actually negative real rates. And cash, therefore, looks deeply unattractive. But, cash does give you flexibility. It does give you some optionality. If assets really tumble in price, you have some firepower there. So, whilst I don't like cash, I think it's important. Why would you lend money to a government, almost any G7 government, at these current yields of 1.5% in the UK nominally? And the answer is, I'm not sure why you would. So I worry that the fixed income universe is a value trap. Now, if it's very short term, and I'm sort of talking about sort of up to 2 years, and there's a little bit of corporate debt in there, fine. But your returns are minimal, so one has to be very careful about reaching for yield in the world of fixed income, because high yields, spreads, and yields have absolutely collapsed, and there's, for my mind, there's very little value there. So if you're talking about inflation protection, which matters for people are up and down every country, particularly those seeing important amounts of savings under threat from inflation, equities can, up to a point, offer you protection, but not all equities, and not if inflation becomes really, really sticky. It depends on how the business is able to manage that inflation. Can the supermarkets pass on that inflation and actually ride out a period of inflation quite well? I think quite possibly. I think that's quite a defensive place to be. But I think that in a world of higher inflation, then you start thinking about your commodity exposure. Well, oil is, of course, dependent on economic activity, and there are some specific issues around oil, which we've talked about. I like the oil sector, and it's had this massive derating, I think probably from a peak of a quarter of the S&P being in oil companies to probably not much more than 5%, and sort of, elsewhere that's similarly the case. So yes, equities, it can offer you protection, and then you start moving into the, what are the other things? Well, obviously the real assets. So, you know, people own property, and if they have large enough investment portfolios, they can own forestry and agricultural land. Although those are, again, quite sophisticated, you know, institutional asset classes when you start talking about it in scale. But I think commodities, you know, are quite interesting. Commodities like platinum and silver, I've been buying, I think look quite attractive risk reward. We always come back to the gold question. I have been persuaded for a long time that I want to have gold in my portfolio. I think one needs to look back at Gordon Brown's extraordinary decision to sell a lot of the UK's gold at $300 an ounce. It's up sixfold from there. I've owned gold for quite a while. It's been a bit lackluster of late because we're in a period of economic expansion. I think when that expansion starts to slow, I think gold starts to look, you know, increasingly attractive. And when people say to me, well, you know, it doesn't have any economic use, that's exactly why you own gold. You don't want to have something that is requires a robust economy, because your gold is there to perform a function when things are significantly less certain. And as the old saying goes, gold is the only asset that doesn't represent anyone else's liability, and all the gold ever mined still fits into two Olympic-sized swimming pools. So I think there are some pretty compelling reasons, particularly with gold having had a nice pullback, to be adding or putting gold into your portfolio.
Speaking of not having economic use, what are your thoughts on cryptocurrencies?
Well, on the Money Miss podcast, we recently did an interview with Nick Carey, who's the founder of blockchain.com, and he made a very articulate case for all of the attributes attached to the cryptocurrencies and their store of value. And I've sort of scratched my head a bit, you know, digital currencies being a store of value, and yet there's 6,000 or more of them. I know Bitcoin only has 21 million, you know, bitcoins in use. So there is a sort of a, you know, there's a cap on that. I think that the underlying technologies around blockchain and around devolved finance are very interesting. I haven't been persuaded that I want to have cryptocurrencies in my portfolio to date.
I think you're right. The interesting part is their uses, and maybe thinking about them in terms of currencies isn't helpful. It's more how they might be able to rewire the financial systems. But I guess you have China banning them to show that the governments can step in to make it very difficult for these decentralized systems to work without government support.
Yes.
Another interesting area is the active versus passive debate. So we'll just start with, in terms of exposure, do you favour active funds or passive funds, or are there different parts of the markets where you would take one over the other?
Well, I sort of was brought up and trained as an active manager, so I essentially believe that active management has a really important role to play. Funnily enough, you and I think both know Robin Wigglesworth from the Financial Times, who's just produced this book, I think as of today, called Trillions. And we interviewed him on the Money Maze podcast, and he makes a very eloquent case for why passive beats active in developed markets, particularly, you know, the US, in most cases. But he will acknowledge that there are managers who can outperform the index. Now, I guess that my own experience has been that a combination of active and passive, you know, makes sense. So I had passive exposure in the UK, as I mentioned. I've had passive exposure to Korea and Taiwan and other indices where I'm sort of going after the there's a valuation opportunity there. Do I feel that I can, you know, access the best managers in that area? If I can, then I might be interested in allocating them. If not, I might just want to own the index. So I think it is a mixture, you know, of the two. The fees, obviously, in the passive world are much lower. But if you take the US right now and you say, well, I want to own the US market and I'm going to go passive, well, it's the, what worries me is, I suppose, the unwind. So, you know, lots of money has flown into those passive vehicles, passive ETFs around, you know, around the index. And, you know, and I think that we'll enter a period at some point where, particularly if we have that shift from growth to value, where, you know, there will be, you know, there'll be some uncomfortable, you know, air pockets in the market. And of course, there are some of these passive vehicles that have been created around very specific and niche opportunities, and some of them, you know, are very risky. But those tend to be the ETFs which have got leverage, and you know. But broadly, passive has an important role to play. Yes.
Do you think? Do you worry about what the sort of structural implications more broadly, you know, money just flowing in to passive funds rather than being selected on merit of the stock price. There was an article saying that by a broker, StoneX, recently saying that trillions of dollars that have gone into these passive funds has inflated the stock market valuations. And while the majority of it might be from monetary policy, they argued that 27% of cyclically adjusted Shiller PE ratios were because of passive money. Do you worry that too much passive might affect the health of the stock market?
Well, I haven't read the article, but I wonder whether there may be a confusion between cause and effect, because it's the central banks with their policies of zero rates and QE that have encouraged people to take more risk and driven them from cash and bonds into equities. That expression, TINA, there is no alternative. Now, that it's the central bank policies and the world we have been inhabiting that have driven people to equities, and the vehicles that they have in large chosen are passive because they are cheap, accessible. But I point the finger of, you know, and I'm going to use the word blame, you know, at the central banks, because there are people who have taken more risk than they would otherwise have done had interest rates been kept at, you know, something, you know, more normal.
And another area that's attracted a lot of money is ESG funds, and we touched on that. You touched on that earlier. It's a very interesting time, I guess, leading into COP26. There's a lot of noise around it, but we've also seen several senior executives whistleblowing recently. You've had Tarek Fancy at BlackRock, an executive at DWS. The regulation's only starting to come in to actually measure ESG credentials. Do you see fund managers at the moment, do you see ESG as a marketing or a real force for good in how the industry is presenting it currently?
Well, I think the financial service industry at large never misses an opportunity to jump on, you know, jump on a moving train that might be accelerating. And it is true that there are lots of offerings out there, many which I'm not familiar with, but some would appear to blandish their credentials. And I'm not sure how much they bear scrutiny in terms of the underlying process. I think that, you know, the drivers are well-founded. You want to invest in companies that are well-governed. You want to invest in companies that are absolutely taking note of their environmental responsibilities and their digital footprint, and you want to have good governance. Now, those should be considerations that you apply to companies, you know, even before the advent of ESG. But I do think that the motivations for having greater attention paid are, you know, are really important. Now, there are some like Warren Buffett who, as you will know, are very skeptical of sort of, you know, of the flavor of this being the flavor of the day, and says, you know, it's economic returns that, you know, that really matter. So I think that the, you know, the ESG universe means that many of those characteristics will be sought out increasingly in investment process, and I think we'll move on and people won't be talking about it because, you know, companies that pollute horribly or run their companies in a way that's deemed to be, you know, inappropriate will be divested from. But then we come, as we touched on earlier on, to, for example, the energy complex, and I think it's much more nuanced there about whether you want to abandon your shareholding or stay on board and be part of the debate. And obviously I come down on the side of being involved and engaged.
Yeah. On the energy point, I think the drive from ESG is part of the reason why there's been a lot of money flowing into these renewable energy infrastructure trusts. We've had lots of launches in recent years, and they're trading on very high premiums to their net asset value. Part of the attraction, I think, people like them is because there is a degree of inflation protection built in, perhaps, on our inflation theme. What's your view on the investment case for these trusts? Because they are quite complicated.
I mean, I actually haven't spent much time looking at them. I always worry about premiums to NAV because the market has a horrible way of then providing you with an opportunity to sell them at a discount later on. So I don't want to be cynical, but I think one needs to be a little bit careful, here. So I think, more generally, infrastructure, again, it's proved to be a very attractive asset category, but I think one just needs to, be careful. Airports look like they were very safe places, in terms of, investing money, and it's proved to be, significantly more, rocky of late. So again, I think that when things become too popular and they look too easy and too fashionable, one just needs to be a little bit, careful.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but I really appreciate having you on. That was really interesting. Thank you.
Well, Mary, thank you very much for asking me to join the show today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.